It's so lovely to be here with all of you on this retreat. Just checking in, making sure the sound is reaching you all. Great, good. It's always good to get a confirmation before I launch into something that does not reach you. So today I'd like to talk about this embodied training that we're on and this practice on the path to liberation. Okay. Thank you. Bell's ringing. That was my alarm. All right. Thank you. So thank you for my support, for your support, Eric. So I'd like to talk tonight on this embodied training that we are engaged in on our path to liberation. And speaking to this process that we're in as we come in retreat, you know, there's a real way that I think of retreat as a way that we're coming home to ourselves, that we're dislodging ourselves from kind of our ordinary operating in the world, even if we are still in our ordinary places. There's this ordinary way that we may behave in the world where we do something and we receive something, and there's these operations and these procedures that happen. That's very transactional. Like, I'm doing this in order to get that, and then I do this and I get that. And on retreat, we're really stepping into this mystery of all the causes and conditions that have happened up to this time. That means that we all have arrived here together in this space to practice for the liberation of ourselves and all beings. And so we're seeing ourselves through this lens of freedom, through this lens of freedom, not just for ourselves, but for the world, for all beings. And so this is this path of caring, of kindness, where we shift to really looking at our actions with reverence, this sense of the sacred that we were talking about earlier in the retreat. And in the Buddha's training, in the talking of what it means to be on this path, there's three parts that are often spoken to. And many of you will be familiar with this, well, the many Buddhist lists. And this one is the Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. And so when we look at our path and our training, we can look at it through this lens. And Sila, S-I-L-A in Pali, is often translated as ethics or virtue or morality. And that is thought of as a real foundation to what we're doing. That the way that we are living in our body, in our speech, in our mind, and engaging with each other with this undeniable love. How are we creating a whole integral integrity? How are we creating integrity for ourselves and for our world? And then the second aspect of the path is Samadhi, S-A-M-A-D-H-I in the Pali. And that is translated in many different ways. In the very narrow sense of translation, it's concentration or meditation, which is what we've been focusing on here. And in a broader understanding, it's this harmonizing of mind, this way that we can bring the mind together and harmonize mindfulness, meditation, this whole aspect of the cultivation of the mind. And then the third part is Panya, which is P-A-N-N-A in the Pali, with the little funny squiggles on the ends, N-Y-A-S. And that's wisdom or insight. And this is not the wisdom that we have trained in most of our schooling in this culture in the United States, where we get book learned and we get an analytical mind that is very, very useful in solving problems and things like that. But this is a cultivation of wisdom. where insight arises, where we're seeing clearly. And so it's an experiential knowledge of the way things are in the world, the way things have come to be. And so you may get the sense when you know there's some people who are super smart, like you may be like, wow, they are really learned. They've gotten maybe a PhD or two masters. And then you're like, but are they always wise? So this wisdom has this bit of an intuitive aspect to it, that where we're realizing or perceiving the true nature of reality, not as we want them to be, not as we break them into our perceptions and concepts around them. This wisdom is not a conceptual understanding. It's seeing clearly into what are called the three characteristics, which I'm not going to go into tonight, but I'll just mention. So the wisdom is seeing clearly into the three characteristics, which are impermanence, that the world is changing, that there's no abiding self, and that there's this thing called unsatisfactoriness and stress that arises. So these are the three things that we can use to help understand wisdom in this way. So we may seem like we're just focusing on this one aspect of the path here during our retreat, this middle part of samadhi or meditation, but really we're bringing along these other two. It's kind of like a hologram that you can't actually separate them. And so this integrity and the wisdom will come along, and depends on this kind of almost the perspective and how we're looking at it. So there's ways of knowing and ways of seeing. And so as one engages through one, the others can be cultivated, and vice versa. The Buddha says it like this in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Such is sila, such is samadhi, such is panya. When sila is fully developed, samadhi is of great fruit and benefit. When samadhi is fully developed, panya is of great fruit and benefit. So this really speaks to the underlying necessity of the foundation of looking at our ethics. And one of the things that I think about ethics is this, in our retreat right now, where many of us are engaged, more some than others, with other people, is like, how do I apply this path, not only to the inner mind states, but to this outer world of people who say and do things? During my meditation retreat, wait a second, this is not supposed to be happening. And so how do I act with integrity within all of that? And so I'd like to suggest that we can use this same practice that we've been doing all along for meditation, this practice of the four foundations that Bob was talking, as mentioned, it's called the Satipatthanas. And we've been focusing a lot on the contemplation of body, mindfulness of the body sitting, the body moving, the body doing dishes, the body brushing teeth, the body eating, just being mindful of the body. And then this morning, this contemplation of mindfulness of Vedana, of feeling tone. And this is noticing the accompanying, I really like the term valence that Bob used, a valence of each moment. So I'm eating and it's pleasant, but then I eat another bite, it's unpleasant. And then the next one, neutral. So noticing both the body and the accompanying valence of it. And then the next two are contemplation of the mind, like what's happening in the mind. And then the fourth one is the contemplations of the dharmas, the Buddha's teachings. And so today I'm going to be talking a little bit in this about these mind states. And the Buddha, you know, at least for me, this instills great confidence in me and the power and transformative process of this path. The Buddha says about this path of the four Satipatthanas that this is the direct path for the removal of worry and sorrow, for being without vexations, for attaining great knowledge and wisdom, for accomplishing the realization of Nibbana. I don't know. I would probably sign up if I heard that's pretty good advertisement that this is the direct path, this one that we are all practicing here for removal of worry and sorrow, for being without vexations, for that insight, that wisdom, for accomplishing Nibbana. Now, the translation of Nibbana that really lands well for me is that Nibbana is this heart, mind, body that is free from greed, free from hatred, and free from ignorance. So the realization of what it means to be free from these forces of hatred, these forces of greed, and the forces of ignorance. So this path that we're on, this unfolding, while it may not seem like we're getting close to being free from greed, but just that watching, that attending to the mindfulness, the loving awareness that we're cultivating of coming back to this moment is a piece of this path. And a lot of times we focus on the first two, the greed and the aversion, and I will talk about a little bit more about them later, but I wanted to start by inviting us into ignorance. It's not a really fun place to begin, but it's actually this place that it's not very fun to acknowledge that I'm ignorant. But there's so much that I'm ignorant about. I don't know how you're all thinking or feeling, especially because you're not in the room with me. I can't even get an energetic sense. I don't know if this is the right talk for you at this time. Maybe it is for some, maybe for not. I don't know if I'm going to do a good job. I don't know what will happen tomorrow. There's so many things I'm ignorant of. And because there's so much ignorance, I often try to pretend like I think I know. I set up my perceptions, the way the world will run. I'll say this, you'll do that. And then, like if it was the movies, there'd be a happy ending, or maybe it's a thriller and there's not such a happy ending. But, there's this way that we think the world runs, and then we create the world in that image. And so I invite ourselves into kind of some of what Bob was referring to with, the not knowing. This uncertainty of the world that we live in. And certainly there's enough that we can see right now that really lets us know the truth of the changing nature of our world, this uncertainty of our time. There's been so many changes this year that I could never have imagined would happen, that this truth of uncertainty is something that I've really come to cherish this year. Because I didn't believe these things would happen there. How many other things are possible for my life, for our lives together, collectively? And yet, there is this sense within me that I want to have a constant world, that I want the world to be a certain way, that I want these blocks that I can just sort of like when you're a kid and you build your towns and then you drive little cars or the people go in and out of the stores and everything to be a certain way. And we hold on to that view. And so that's an interesting place to notice that even though with one hand we can see this uncertainty, at this other hand that there's still this belief in the constancy and there's some comfort in that belief. Pema Chodron, many of you know, amazing Shambhala meditation teacher. In the book, When Things Fall Apart, Heartful Advice for Hard Times, it's very appropriate for us. She says, we think that the point is to pass the test or overcome the problem, but the truth is that things don't really get solved. They come together and they fall apart. And then they come together again and fall apart again. It's just like that. The healing comes from letting there be room for all of this to happen, room for grief, for relief, for misery, for joy. So we have this idea that there's like this linear path that we're progressing on. That's always almost like those signs that all the corporations want to see, that the arrow is always going up and that we're always getting better. But how does that myth really support us when that is not the world? That the world is that they come together and they fall apart and they come together again and they fall apart again. And it's just like that. You know, in Pema Chodron's other book, and sometimes I think all I have to do is read her titles, and she says, the other book, Comfortable with Uncertainty, 108 Teachings on Cultivating Fearlessness and Compassion. So this really is this way that we can build stamina with this discomfort of the world, the ever-changing nature of the world, this mindfulness, this transformative power, these teachings of the Buddha, because certainly the Buddha lived in a world that had war, that had famine, that had hardship, that had poverty, that had caste system, that had inequality. And yet, there is a way that we can transform ourselves in relationship to these situations in the world. And so one of the interesting things for me as a practitioner is that the Buddha offered us some teachings. And yet, as you read the Buddhist teachings, there are ways that, you know, they kind of are moving a little bit for this person or that person, or there's sometimes how do I engage with these teachings? What does it mean for me in my particular location and who I am? And so what I'd like to offer tonight is focusing on five mental forces, because this is the third thing, the mental factors that the Buddha described that have been around for, you know, over 2,500 years that we can still practice with now. And so these are characteristics of the mind that we often take personally, but since the Buddha described them 2,500 years ago, you know, they're not personal. They're just forces of the mind. And in Pali, they're known as the five Nivarana, N-I-V-A-R-A-N-A. And I bring that up because as soon as I say the English word, everyone's going to be like, ugh. So in English, the translation is hindrances. And I think that's quite unfortunate because, like, the excitement about studying anything that's a hindrance does not sound like we're on that path to liberation. It sounds like it's that, you know, off ramp where you end up with your flat tire over there. And, you know, I'd really rather be on that super highway, the one that the Buddha says leads to freedom. And so I bring up this place because these are mental factors. These are forces of the mind that we all have. And yet it's so easy for us to get caught in them. And in translation from Pali, the word that's often used instead of hindrances, the closely related word is coverings. And so in this way, the hindrances cover our minds so that we kind of think we're going in the right direction, but have like a veil or a covering. And so they hinder our ability to see clearly and our capacity to develop this stable, balanced mind. The Buddhist meditation teacher Gloria Taranya Ambrosia calls the hindrances the coping strategies of the unawakened mind, because it's said that we all have the hindrances until we are awakened. And so these are our coping strategies. But if I think about this word coverings, I could also think about the hindrances as being sort of disguises or facades, or almost a way that we think we're masquerading as being awakened. Like that we get some sort of taste or flavor of a little bit of freedom and we think maybe that's it. So I wanted to share this quote from James Baldwin about masks, because I think it really helps to see how we can get caught in these with these masks. And you probably have heard this quote because it's often used. And he wrote, "Love takes off the masks that we fear we cannot live without and know we cannot live within." Let me read that again. He says, "Love takes off the masks that we fear we cannot live without and know we cannot live within." So, to me, when I think about this aspect of love, it leads me to this sense of the integrity and ethics of life. And he continues in this quote, and he says, "I use the word love here, not merely in the personal sense, but as a state of being or a state of grace. Not in the infantile American sense of being made happy, but in the tough and universal sense of quest and daring and growth." So this way that we take off these masks and engage fully from this heart and this place of love, so that we can open to these places that could be challenging and difficult with a sense of daring and a hope for growth. And I think this way of looking at it as a mask to me was really helpful to think of, because I don't always know the masks that I'm wearing or the masks that other people put on me. And this is a place that I'm just ignorant. And ignorance is not something that's my fault. If I don't know it, I don't know it. But I can learn and pay attention with my mindfulness practice. And then we can begin to see where we're mistaken in our understanding. Sometimes, I don't know about you, but sometimes I have like an inkling. Like you get a sense of like, there's something not exactly right here, but I don't know what it is. And I have begun to, with my mindfulness practice, to begin to able to feel that in the body. Luckily, as many of you probably have friends who are also meditators, and so like it's probably 4 or 5 years into my practice, maybe longer, I'm sad to say, but I was walking with this friend and I made her stop, and I was like, oh, I just had a gut feeling. You know, I hadn't, like people always said, you have this feeling in your gut that you know something, but I had never quite had it at the same time. And so I was like, wait, wait, I have to feel this. I just had that gut feeling when you said something. And that's the process of like something happens and then we can attune to what's happening here in this heart, mind, body. And we can begin to see clearly, take off those masks. So, the reason why I bring up these five hindrances or five coverings is because we can directly practice with them. So, often what will happen is that something will arise in our life and we think it's our fault. I did this, this is wrong, I need to fix it. Or you did this is wrong, you need to fix it. They did this is wrong, they need to fix it. And we just kind of keep going on and on. But these we can become to know, and we can learn how to practice for ourselves and in community. And so the basic instruction, the lowest bar, if you will, of the Buddhist teaching about the hindrances is no one is present, no one is not present. So everybody check in right now. Let's just start with the first one right now, sense desire. Is it present? Is it not present? Well, then you get like, well, how do I know if it's present? Sense desire would occur in one of the six senses. So the ears, the eyes, the nose, mouth. What did I forget? And then the mind. So are we wanting something? Is there a wanting? Do I want a certain taste? Do I want a certain smell? Do I want it to feel a certain way? Is it here? Is it not here? And the not here is a really interesting one, because if it's not here, then we can celebrate. wow, I'm not craving any sense desires right now. And then there's that place where the Vedana, which may have been neutral, might get to be slightly pleasant. And we can rest in that knowing that it's possible to just be contented right then. And so we can, when we do this, we can drop into the body and we can kind of figure out what is the attitude in the mind. And I would like to suggest, having worked for over 20 years with students, children, kindergarten through mostly elementary, but also middle school, that instead of thinking of this as your homework, that you think about this more like you're at recess, like you're on the playground. And so that it's not something that you have to do, but it's something that you play with, like, what's it feel like in the body? Do I feel anything in the toes? Am I on the monkey bars right now, or am I going down the slide? You know, what does it feel like? What is happening for you in the mind? What's happening in the mind? Does somebody in front of me in line for the tetherball and I'm getting frustrated? Or did I just, you know, feel the success of getting that tetherball around the pole? That bring that lightness that can kind of begin to open up that sense of identification that it's my fault that I'm feeling this craving, that rather than these are things that go through us. So I wanted to share a couple of the descriptions of the Buddha offered us, because these hindrances are so rich that the Buddha also used lots of metaphors to describe them. And since we're thinking about them as masks, I wanted to use these metaphors that he offered that have to do with a pot of water. And I think somebody mentioned how they often look at like use a pot of water as a mirror. And so for this first hindrance or covering of sense desire, the Buddha describes it this way. And so just thinking about yourself when you have, like, and you're seeing something, or for example, and the Buddha says, if there is a pot of water mixed with orange, yellow, indigo, or crimson dye, and a person with good sight should consider their own facial image in it, they could not recognize nor see it as it really is. So too, when someone abides with their mind pervaded with sensual desire, overcome by wanting. So here's this person who's looking in this pot of water, and then there's all these colors. Sounds so beautiful. Like, wouldn't it be fun to just see myself as like this multicolored, you know, it's like I'm going to a party or something. So that might be part of it, but is that really seen clearly? Is that going to, what's going to lead towards freedom? It's not to say that we can't have fun and wear colors and things like that, but this is, when do we see clearly? Because once I know I'm not seeing clearly, then I'm seeing clearly. And one of the things that sense desires points to is the mask that we think that we're liberated when we get pleasant things. When things are going well, there's this accompanied thing of like, I must be doing something right. And then when things aren't going well, then there's a thought of like, I must be doing, or you, you know, depending on what it is. So being able to have this space between the pleasant helps us see that there are these causes, myriad causes and conditions that are happening that bring rise to the pleasant. Where did these colors come from? How are they arising? What is happening now? And then the image that the Buddha offers for the second one, so this, the first two are kind of coupled. The first one is the sense desire of wanting, and the second one is very similar of the aversion of not wanting or pushing away, ill will, or aversion, it's often called. And this has many ranges, could be dislike or irritation or frustration or rage or hatred. But the image here is also quite visual. And he says, if there is a pot of water heated over a fire, bubbling and boiling, and a person with good sight should consider their own face image in it. They could not recognize nor see it as it really is. So too, when someone abides with their mind pervaded by ill will, overcome with aversion. So when we have this mask of irritation, there's a sense, I mean, we can feel it. And this is where we can come into the body and we can feel that bubbling, the fiery. And then, you know, sometimes we seek to push things away. That's the aversion. And oftentimes the Vedana can be quite unpleasant. But at the same time, I mean, if we think purely of the fire, there are times that we want fire to cook our food or to do different things. So it's not necessarily the fire is bad. The anger is bad. We don't need to make that association, or I am the personality that gets in there. Using this Vedana of like unpleasant boiling helps support this. So I was hoping that we could practice for a moment with these two different mind states just to see what it's like to embody them. So the first thing I would like you to do is just to bring to mind something that's pleasant, some sense desire, just for this exercise, make it an object. Think of something that you really want. It could be your favorite meal, or maybe there's a shoes that you like, or just something that you find pleasant. And then close your eyes and imagine like it's just out in front of you. And then reach out your hand if you would like to, and see what it feels like to be reaching for that, whatever it is, that thing that's going to provide this pleasant sensation. That pleasant sensation could be in the mind, it could be in the eyes or the ears, maybe it's beautiful music. Notice in the body what it feels like. Now take your other arm, and if you have your arm, and then just gently bring that arm back and support it. And notice what it likes to be, to feel back in balance, if you will. Because if you're like me, when I'm wanting that pleasant leaning into, I'm off balance. And so that's kind of where we get caught, because there's that sense, the wanting can get so exciting that we can think just about there. And it's really can, there's an excitement in it. And that can be a mask that I'm going somewhere, I'm getting something. But who is this I that's going somewhere? What is this thing that's impermanent that I want to get? Where is the suffering in that? So now let's just take the second one here, this experience of aversion. So for this one, if you care to play along here, is just clench your fist, if that's available to you. Just like something you really don't want happening. Maybe just a little something, just like, I'm kind of bringing to mind a little toddler as I do it. I could just sort of feel that sense. All right. And now imagine you're doing this in your meditation practice and you want to stop. So you're just like making, like you can take your other hand and see if you can make it stop. Like, can you make this contraction? Like, can you unwind? Like, I don't want to have aversion. I'm going to make it go away. And you're probably not getting very far with that. But if you take your other hand and you just provide some support, just not needing to do anything, just providing some support, then you might. And like my hand's pretty tightly grasped, so it's not like coming undone very quickly. But you might begin to see that with support, there might be some opening. And I bring this to mind because it's really important to allow us the time and the patience and the perseverance with these so-called hindrances. that are our path, that they actually can be gateways to opening. But they're not going to do it because, you know, I'm going to crack this aversion right now. It's not a linear process like that. And the other thing that I want to speak to with these hindrances as well is that sometimes there's an intuitive sense of the body, especially if we've had traumatic experiences, that these experiences of aversion or wanting something might be hooked in with histories of our families, of our culture. And so paying attention to that sense of resistance, that resistance might be telling us my wholesome wisdom in that point. So that way of like, I'm gonna get to this bottom of this, we might wanna hold it with some more spaciousness. So the other the next two of the hindrances are some that we've already spoken about because they often come up early on in retreats. And the next one is sloth and torpor, which is the tiredness that happens in the body and the sluggishness in the mind. And then the other one that is like the flip side, which is the restlessness and worry. So this is the agitation in the body or the mind. And these, as I say, these are mental factors that are arising in us for due to causes and conditions. And sometimes we begin to think that there's a problem, that we think that there's something I did around that. But they're really just factors that are happening in the mind and the body. And so the images here that I want to share, because I just find them so helpful, and some people I know can really help to grasp what they mean by listening to the Buddha's teachings here. So for sloth and torpor, the description, the metaphor is a pot of water covered with algae and water plants, and a person with good sight should consider their own facial image in it they could not recognize nor see it as it really is. So too, when someone abides with their mind pervaded by lethargy and drowsiness. So there's just like, you know, you just can't, there's something happening that clouds the mind that doesn't allow us to see clearly. And then I'll give you some practices around this, but let me describe the restlessness and worry image before I do that. So for restlessness and worry, the description is if there is a pot of water stirred by the wind, agitated, swirling, producing wavelets, and a person with good sight should consider their own facial image in it, they would not recognize nor see it as it really is. So too, when someone abides with their mind pervaded by restlessness and worry. So this sense of agitation, you're looking to try to see things clearly, but it's like a windy day and all those leaves are like whipping by and I'm trying to see clearly, but the conditions are such that it's just hard to figure out. And so remember, the first thing that the Buddha says to do is to know that the hindrance is present. So knowing that agitation is present, oh, it's a windy day, like the weather. Oh, there's algae today on the pond. You know, in the summer, if you see a pond, sometimes it's grown as algae. You're just not seeing clearly. Or that it's not there. Wow, it's not a windy day. It's a sunny day. So just knowing that it's present or not. And then coming up and checking in with the body. The other thing that I find is helpful, especially with these ones with the body, is inviting spaciousness. So often what we tend to do is we try to attach to the object. So the object could be the breath or the body or the sounds. But if we do spaciousness, we can think about what is around those sounds. So for example, when if you've ever looked at first graders' handwriting or kindergartners' handwriting, you know, when they first start writing and they start writing all the letters and there's no spaces between them. They're just writing, 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 and they can tell you what this says, but you don't know. But then they start and you can kind of see, and they'll put like two fingers between the words, and then you can begin to make out the words. Well, so often we're focused on the words, but not the spaces. So we get fixated on a certain aspect or way of being, and we can create and look at the spaces around it. Just some of you may be musicians, and you know that the spaces on the music are as important as the notes. And so putting the spaciousness so we can see the space around the forms and take a different perspective. If we take a different perspective, that can open up the energy from sluggishness or agitation, and can really help us practice with these mind states so that we don't identify and solidify around them. And the last hindrance is that of doubt. And let me share the image for this, because the image is quite evocative to me. The Buddha says, if there is a pot of water that is stirred up, turbid and muddy, placed in the dark, and a person with good sight should consider their own facial image in it, they could not recognize nor see it as it really is. So this is doubt, not being able to recognize, because there's a lot of turbidity and muddiness. And in addition to that, being all shook up, it's placed in the dark. I don't know about you, but like sometimes there's things in the back of the closet that I'm just like, I know something's back, but I can't find it. And I'm just like trying to find these things that I thought I knew. And it's just like, I thought this, you know, just kind of like coming up against that. And so once again, being for me, it's been really helpful to be like, I'm trying to make a decision. I'm like, what should I do? And I'm like, oh, this is doubt. This is doubt. I don't know what to do here. It's not clear. I'm in the back of the closet trying to find that thing. And so these are habit patterns of mind that I'm thinking I'm trying to find clarity from a spot where the conditions are such that the clear seeing is really hard to be with. And so one of the things that I think happens is that if we can have this continuity of practice with the foundations of mindfulness, then we can see these mind states when they arise, the sense desires, the aversion, restlessness, the sloth and torpor, the doubt. And we can come into the body and we can begin to know, you know, what happens in the body. Oh, what does doubt like in the body? And so the rather than be like, oh my gosh, I don't know what to do, you can be like, oh, this is doubt. This is what doubt feels like. Right now, doubt is unpleasant, or maybe this agitation is actually kind of pleasant right now. I'm feeling like, oh, I can run. You know, I have this. So there's this sense of really going into this complexity, but simplifying our practice as we go into it. And really understanding that might not seem like we're kind of going where we think we want to be going, because the path is a little unclear. Because we really aren't on a linear path. We're each on our own path, and we're doing that collectively, just as we're all supporting each other in this minute. And so, as we are each doing this, we're supporting each other with the care and the abiding with each other. And that's part of the integrity that our practice is, that inclination towards kindness for ourselves, kindness for each other. And so, to me, it's really important to remember that these hindrances, these masks, coverings, are the path, that they themselves are the gateways to awakening, that this freedom from greed, wanting the world to be a certain way, what if it's just unpleasant right now? What if it's a windy day? And so they also be gateways to knowing ourselves, because we can begin to know the patterns, the habit tendencies of each one of us. These habit tendencies that have been conditioned by our culture, by our family, by our society, and we can see how they arise in each one of us. And so as we get to know them within ourselves, they can be gateways to freedom in our relationships with ourselves and each other. And we can begin to see how our perceptions of the world arise. And with mindfulness and loving attention, we can uncover how to attend. How do I attend like a garden? How do I attend this body, heart, and mind with these patterns, these histories, knowing that I have this practice, mindfulness, compassion, kindness. And so this uncovering of these covers, we can, with so many things in Buddhism, we can intend towards it, and then it will unfold of its own accord, not in the way we want or the way we think it will or the way we think it should look. It's kind of mysterious in that way, this gradual path. And sometimes it feels like, oh, I'm on a roll, I'm having all this insight. And then at another point, it just feels like we're stalled. But that could actually be something, you know, percolating under the surface, something beginning to germinate. So this path requires so much patience and perseverance and commitment. And the commitment is to being with ourselves with as much kindness and caring and attending as we are to understand the hindrances and how they're hindering us from this way of being free from greed, free from hatred, free from delusion. And because when we don't know hatred in ourselves, it's hard to know when we're giving that to someone else. When we don't know greed in ourselves, it's hard to know when we're being greedy in relationship to others. And so this internal and external become seamless for how we engage in the world. So one of the images that I really love for the path is, and I guess it was a couple of years ago, I read the image of the Buddha as the great blossomed one, like a, you know, that he had blossomed into being. And I find that that supports me a lot, because each of us will blossom, and you know, we're not a monocrop, you know, we're not gonna all become the cornfield, you know, in lines, and each become, we're going to blossom into who we truly are as we tend to ourselves and supportive in our communities. And so that's what I would hope for each of you on this path, as you practice with these mind states, with these practices that the Buddha offered us, so that we can live a life of integrity that brings us insight and wisdom and moments of calm for ourselves and for all beings. So thank you for your kind attention. Let's just sit for a moment. Thank you so much. We have